Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny. And tonight's show features a pre-recorded interview with the psychologist Cordelia Fine. Dr. Cordelia Fine is an academic psychologist and writer. She is the author of A Mind of Its Own, How Your Brain Distorts and Deceives, and writes regularly for the press. She wrote the introduction for the Britannica Guide to the Brain, and her second book, Delusions of Gender, The Real Science Behind Sex Difference, is out now from Icon Books. Cordelia studied experimental psychology at Oxford University, followed by an MPhil in criminology at Cambridge University. She was awarded a PhD in psychology from the University College London. From 2002 to 2007, she was a research associate at Monash University and then at the Australian National University. She is currently a research associate at the Centre for Agency, Values and Ethics at Macquarie University, and an honorary research fellow at the Department of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne.
Cordelia, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Oh, thank you for having me on the programme.
We're going to be talking about your book, Delusions of Gender, The Real Science Behind Sex Differences. It's probably a ridiculously easy point to start on, but let's talk about what we're talking about here. What are the perceived sex differences?
Well, the differences that we think there are between men and women, of course, is a different question to what the differences are between men and women. So if we look first at brains, if you're sort of an avid reader of popular science books about gender, then you probably formed the opinion that science has shown, for example, that there are quite important differences between the brains of men and women that make them think and feel and behave differently. And what I discovered from taking a closer look at the science of sex differences, and particularly the neuroscience of sex differences, is that there's actually surprisingly little convincing evidence that there is such a thing as a male brain that's hardwired to be good at understanding the world and a female brain that's hardwired to understand people. But unfortunately, the idea of hardwired sex differences is very confidently presented as fact by many popular writers. And the problem then becomes that these claims about male brains and female brains then reinforce gender stereotypes in a way that can have sort of self-fulfilling psychological effects, which takes me to the sort of second part of my answer to your question about, well, what do we think of being the differences between men and women and what actually are the differences between men and women? Well, of course, there's a sort of very long-standing idea that men are thinkers and women are feelers, which has sort of been given a new terminology by the Cambridge psychologist Simon Baron Cohen, who describes men on average as being more likely to systemize, which is understand systems, work out how they work and build them and so on, whereas he describes women on average as being more likely to be empathizers, so understanding other people and responding to them sympathetically.
We'll look at the science in a bit more detail a bit later, but let's talk about the systematizers and the empathizers bit, and let's look at historically where that idea comes from. When did that really first start?
I don't know precisely when it started, but a philosopher called Nicolas Malebranche, who was vaguely a contemporary of Descartes, so if there are philosophers listening, they'll be like, oh, doesn't she know anything, this woman? But round about that time, he was already talking about the fact that women are incapable of abstract thought, as he put it, and he even had a neurological explanation for it, which was that the neural fibres were too soft, and that was why they weren't capable of, you know, thinking about complex abstract things in the same way that men were. So that's talking about some time ago that idea has been carrying on. But if you sort of fast forward to sort of 21st century psychology, what you find is, for example, when you take the idea, you know, very commonly, very popularly perceived to be true, which is that women are you know, more empathic than men, there's a such a thing as womanly intuition, you find, well, actually, when gender fades into the psychological background, men and women's empathic behaviour becomes identical. But when the environment makes gender salient, or, you know, gendered expectations salient, then you do actually see the expected difference with women outperforming men. And since this is general finding in social psychology, that when gender is in the psychological background, men and women's behaviour becomes much more similar, even in areas where traditionally the sexes do perform differently. But when the environment makes gender salient, which, you know, can be done very subtly both in the lab and, of course, happens all the time in real life, there's a sort of ripple effect on our mind. So our thinking and our behaviour, the way we perceive ourselves and even the way we perceive others becomes more consistent with gender stereotypes. And what I found, what was disconcerting about the book was evidence I found that claims about hardwired sex differences really seem to perhaps be at the core of power of gender stereotypes to influence us in these kinds of self-fulfilling ways.
Well, I said the idea of talking about the essential gender differences was like quite a sort of simple question. I meant, you know, we all know this. Everybody knows this idea about women being more empathetic. And one of these reasons is because it's these ideas are so embedded in our society. If we're talking particularly about, obviously, modern Western society here. And you spend the first part of the book talking about ways in which this is so and how this has come to be. So let's look at some of these ideas. And the first thing I'd like to look at is something called the stereotype threat. So tell us what that is.
Well, stereotype threat is a psychological phenomenon that psychologists have been exploring for the last decade or so. And in relation to the topic of gender differences, what they've found is that when we're trying to do something that's traditionally regarded as being the specialty of the other sex, so for example, if you're a woman taking a math test or you're a man taking some kind of social sensitivity test, then we're doing it under the cloud of what they call stereotype threat. And so what happens is that if gender stereotypes are primed in some way, or our social identity as a man or a woman is primed, this actually interferes with our ability to perform the task, and it can also interfere with our interest in it. And so there's really been an explosion of work in this area over the last 5 years, and there's all sorts of really fascinating research into this phenomenon trying to unravel how and when, why it happens. But I think what's most interesting are the studies that show what happens when you sort of blow the cloud of stereotype threat away, because that really reveals just what a powerful psychological phenomenon it is. For example, when you take women performing, taking math tests, you don't have to say anything to a woman to create stereotype threats. So the sort of default position in our culture is, well, okay, there's an understanding that women are stereotypically seen as being inferior at math compared to men. So if you want to create stereotype threat, actually you don't have to do anything at all. But if you want to disperse stereotype threat, then you just have to do something like say, well, actually, on this particular test, you tell your participants, women do just as well as men. And when you do something like that, something reassuring, that sort of reassures women that however they perform, they're not going to be confirming negative gender stereotype about their group. Women actually perform significantly better than you'd expect from, for example, their course scores or their test scores. And what this indicates is that generally when women are in these difficult maths tests at university or at high school, their maths performance is, as one group of researchers describe it, is kind of like the time of a track star who's running into a headwind. So you're kind of underestimating what she's actually capable of if you remove the headwind, in other words, if you take away the stereotype threat effect.
Related to this is environmental effects and whether or not a person feels accepted in a certain environment. And the example I'd like to talk about that you talk about in the book here is in computer science and the sort of stereotype of the male computer science geek and the tests that were done into the effect that that has.
Well, yeah, this is a really interesting sort of natural experiment that was done at the Carnegie Mellon Computer Science Department. And what happened is when the experiment or the study began, they had a very low numbers of women. And the men were sort of, you know, they were your typical geeks. They were very interested. They sort of dreamed in code was how it's described. And they were sort of less interested in the sort of applications of computer science. And then they changed the admission criteria for entry into the computer science course. And they actually took action to try and encourage more female participants as well by going out into schools and so on and so forth. And they changed the criteria so as to not unfairly exclude people who didn't have a lot of programming experience, because they'd found that actually that wasn't a great predictor of how well, you know, how good a computer scientist graduates would become. And so they actually managed to increase the proportion of women quite significantly at the university. And what the researchers found was that actually this sort of more gender equal environment had a sort of quite remarkable effect on the geek level of the people there. So even the students who had been admitted according to the old kind of hacker criteria by the end of it became much more sort of well-rounded and less geeky individuals. I say that with apologies to anyone who would describe themselves in that way. There's a joke, well-rounded people are pointless, so, you know, I'll just throw that in. So, you know, they describe them as, they would describe themselves, oh, well, I play in band now, and I perform in theatre, and I play the violin, and, you know, they describe themselves as being more well-rounded, and also the gender differences, where before the few women that there had been in the course had been more interested in applications, and the men had been sort of more interested in the sort of nitty-gritty of the code. That was actually a point of similarity between the sexes by the time they reached the end of the course. And I suppose what's interesting about it is, well, one point is that the sort of idea of the computer science geek, to be geeky is not, you can argue, intrinsically necessary to be good at computer science. I mean, presumably these people weren't any worse at computer science by the end of the course than they were at the beginning. But secondly, other work by Sapna Sherian and at the University of Washington suggests that, you know, that sort of geeky culture, which actually, you know, isn't probably anything intrinsic to do with being good at computer science, might be putting women off because it's so contrary to this gender stereotype of being female. So what she found was that even just changing the surroundings of the computer science department when people came in to assess how interested they might be in taking computer science, when they had a very kind of geek chic kind of environment, the women were much less interested than men.
So this was basically taking down the Star Trek posters and tidying away the empty pizza boxes and stuff.
That's right, exactly. And they had sort of wires and things trailed around and very technical magazines and things. And then for the other participants, they put up nature pictures and they had general level magazines around and just those traces of geekiness removed. And in those situations, the women actually showed equal interest to men in taking part in computer science. And what they say is, well, look, what they point to is, and this is sort of touches on a more general point, is they describe it as the ambient environment and the power of the environment to sort of signal to people, yes, you will belong here, you can fit in here, or no, you don't belong here, you won't fit, you won't be happy.
The last point on this issue then that I'd like to briefly explore is you talk about how even today, even amongst high-achieving women, there is still quite a strong effect in the home environment and how the sort of the pull of the idea of the breadwinner against the caregiver is still incredibly strong.
Yeah, I have to admit those statistics really shock me. So what sociologists find is that in general women do quite a lot more childcare and housework than men, even if they're both working full-time. And you might say, well, if the man's earning more than the woman, then, you know, it's not really fair. But in the sort of trade union negotiations that marriages can become sometimes, probably makes sense that he's got more bargaining power, so she ends up doing more. But what you find is that when women start to, their earning power starts to equal that of men, you know, it gets a little bit fairer. But when women actually overtake men and they're out-earning them, there's this strange backlash effect whereby she actually starts doing even more childcare and housework. And sociologists describe this as gender deviance neutralization. So the idea is that there's just something so disconcerting about this reversal of who's the primary breadwinner that in a way to kind of make things all right again, the women start going, well, no, look, I really am, you know, I am a caregiver too, and they sort of do more and more laundry and washing up and so on and so forth. And, you know, I really found this extraordinary. I looked at all the data and it seemed perfectly well done and so on and so forth. And then actually I did have conversations with women whose husbands were unemployed or had lost their jobs for long periods of time. And, you know, all of them said to me that they they did nothing and the women had to carry on doing everything else. I mean, I probably would have thought they were just moaning and sort of unfairly complaining about their husbands had I not encountered this phenomenon that sociologists had identified. And I think this is a real difficulty for women, obviously. The second shift is exhausting. And when you think about very prestigious and demanding jobs, they're often described as being two-person jobs. In other words, you actually need someone behind you taking care of things at home and so on and taking care of you in order to be able to do them. And I think it is much rarer for women to have such a partner if they're heterosexual than it is for men. You can try to have an egalitarian marriage or you can have a peaceful marriage, but it's not particularly easy to have both. I mean, there are these norms and expectations, and sociologists describe women who are struggling to get more help from their husbands. They describe it as actively negotiating gendered norms and so on and so forth, and basically they're arguing, and arguing is tiring and generally unpleasant.
You're listening to Little Atoms this week with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Cordelia Fine about her book Delusions of Gender. So now let's move on to some of the signs that you mentioned in the first half, Cordelia. I've written signs here in inverted commas, which I can't really get across on the radio, but there's been numerous attempts made to sort of identify the essential gender differences in hard science. As you mentioned in the first half, when you actually have looked into some of these, you know, the actual evidence turns out to be a lot flimsier than on first appearance. We'll look at a few examples, and the first one you talk about in the book is around the concept of the fetal fork, the massive introduction of testosterone into the fetus at 8 weeks, which determines then the male development. So let's talk about how this is seen to be significant.
Yeah, so the idea that the fetal fork is, as you say, that male babies encounter or are exposed to much higher levels of fetal testosterone, and the idea is that this wires the sort of male brain that's interested in objects and things and understanding the world, and the girls have a lower level. On average, there's a little bit of overlap. Girls sort of are wired to have a female brain that's more interested in people. And this moment in gestation is described more or less extravagantly by various popular writers. And it's, I mean, what's interesting is it's always presented as just a scientific established fact, as if, you know, there are known effects of fetal testosterone in the brain. But the devil really is in the detail with this kind of work. And when you take a close look at the sort of assumptions and methods and results of the studies that have been used to support this idea, what you find is that there are some really important question marks over what the various ways of investigating this idea really show. So there's a whole series of studies that take measures of testosterone during gestation and then look to see how that relates to later behaviours in empathising and systemising when the child's, you know, 1 year or more, up to about 5 years or 7 years old. The first problem with these studies is actually that this is a sort of quite a stumbling block right from the start, is that there's a real question mark over whether researchers are actually measuring fetal testosterone in these studies. So under normal circumstances, researchers can't extract blood samples from fetuses. I mean, that normally when you take testosterone samples, you take it from the blood. And there doesn't seem to be any evidence that the various measures that they do use instead actually relate well or even at all to the actual exposure of the unborn baby to testosterone. So the kinds of measures that they use instead are, for example, the levels of testosterone in the mother, which actually aren't different regardless of whether the mother has got a carrying a male baby or a female baby, so, you know, which is a bit odd if you think that's, you know, indicating fetal testosterone. Or they can sample it from the amniotic fluid. So, of course, babies develop in the amniotic sac and they're surrounded by fluid. So when women undergo amniocentesis during pregnancy, that fluid is used to take testosterone levels. But again, there isn't really any evidence either to support or dispute the idea that testosterone in the fluid, which is, you know, includes waste product from the baby, actually relates to the levels of fetal testosterone sort of coursing through the blood of the baby. So that's a really important issue just from the start. We don't actually know whether we're measuring fetal testosterone. But there are also question marks at the other end too, so the kinds of tests that researchers give children. So, for example, Simon Baron-Cohen, who has done a lot of this work, in a lot of his studies there's a question mark over whether he is actually measuring empathising or systemising, or over, in fact, whether males and females actually differ in these kinds of abilities. So there are sort of general issues with a lot of his measures. When you sort of look at what he's measuring, there is a question mark over whether they are actually tests of empathising or systemising. I mean, even if you set all of these issues aside, when you look at his data, the relationships that you'd expect to see between amniotic testosterone measures and the later behaviours are often messy, they're often inconsistent, and sometimes they're even missing. So generally, it's not very convincing. And I would say, even if we rise above these kind of nitty-gritty points, there's a real question mark over, in my mind, over the very logic behind these kinds of studies. So the kind of background assumption of this work is that there's a sort of neat one-way path from fetal testosterone levels, you know, high fetal testosterone levels, to a male brain, to masculine behaviour. But neuroendocrinologists have had real trouble finding evidence for this kind of neat hormone brain behaviour story, even in animals that are much less complex than we are. So when you just look at fetal testosterone at one point in time during gestation, and then you look at behaviour several years later, that's a lot of intervening, you're leapfrogging over a lot of assumptions.
At a later point in the book on the subject of the science, you describe the authoritative allure of neuroscience in terms of talking about the language in which the studies are couched gives it some sort of inherent authority. Let's talk about that perhaps for a little while.
Neuroscience has a real advantage over psychology. As one person describes it, it sort of ranks much higher in scientificness. So when people think about neuroimaging, they know that there are these very expensive scanners, there are people in white coats, you have these very kind of complex looking pictures of brains with colours on and so forth. And it just seems much more scientific and somehow better than just a paper and pencil test. And in fact, there's a bioethicist called Eric Racine who describes this favouring of neuroscientific information over kind of more boring behavioural data as the phenomenon of neurorealism. So he says, you know, it's extraordinary that you get these, and this has nothing to do with gender, but you'll get these newspaper reports saying, well, we always thought that it was nice to eat unhealthy foods, but now brain scans show that it's really true. So this idea that your own self-report that, you know, you really enjoy eating a cake somehow gets an extra scientific authority from the fact that a certain part of your brain lights up. And the problem when it comes to gender is that you can have a report of a sex difference in the brain when men and women are performing a particular task. And because it's neuroscience and it seems much more scientific, then it's very easy to overlook the fact that decades of behavioural research have shown that the gender gap in this actual behaviour is small or decreasing or actually non-existent altogether. So one of the reasons why neuroscience has this authority is I think because of its scientificness. It does seem more scientific than behavioural data, which is actually completely contrary to what people should be thinking, because in fact, if you want to understand behaviour, if you want to understand differences between men and women, the most direct way is to actually measure their behaviour. It's not to look at patterns of firing in their brain.
Just to finish off on the science part, there's one area that you talk about which muddies the waters a little bit. You talk about the experience of people with something called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Tell us what that is, first of all, and then we could perhaps talk about the studies that have been done of people born with that condition.
Okay, so the condition of congenital adrenal hyperplasia is a genetic condition in which the adrenal glands are sort of produce unusually large amounts of testosterone. It can affect boys and girls, but what's particularly of interest in relation to gender is girls who have this, who have congenital adrenal hyperplasia, because they are exposed to very unusually high levels of testosterone throughout their gestation. And so they have a sort of male hormonal environment, and what this results in is actually they have more or less masculinized genitalia. I mean, sometimes to the extent that at birth they're wrongly thought to be male, but they're reared as girls. So they're seen as a sort of interesting group to look at, because it seems like a way of disentangling high levels of fetal testosterone from the experience of being reared as a boy, because in these girls the two are separated. I have to say there have been lots of false starts with this research, sort of comparing girls with this condition to unaffected girls. So there are lots of sort of initial reports of differences that haven't been borne out. So, for example, it was once thought that they were more intelligent and more aggressive and so on. But what researchers have done a pretty convincing job, in my view, of showing is that girls with congenital adrenal hyperplasia are drawn to boyish toys, and they find girlish toys less appealing than girls without the condition. And this is generally taken as evidence, well, there must be some hardwired component to children's toy preferences. It's not all gender socialisation. But the issue I take with this research is that what the researchers haven't done a very good job of showing is that girls with congenital adrenal hyperplasia are drawn to some intrinsic quality to boyish toys and activities. So they haven't shown that they're drawn to boyish toys because these toys invite movement, or because these toys stimulate their visuospatial skills, or because these toys develop their systemizing abilities. And the reason they haven't shown this is because instead of using gender-neutral toys that differ on these kinds of dimensions, instead researchers just keep using boy toys and girl toys, and that makes it impossible to know for sure, you know, what the appeal is to this group of girls. So is the appeal an intrinsic quality that tends to be shared by boy toys, or is it that for some reason these girls are more comfortable playing with toys that are culturally attached to males? And in thinking about this, it's worth bearing in mind that these girls aren't, you know, simply girls who happen to be exposed to a lot of fetal testosterone and then had perfectly normal experiences being reared as girls. I mean, they're born with masculinized genitalia. They have to undergo surgery to change it to make it look more feminine. That might involve repeated surgeries. They have a lot of medical visits and so on. They get queried a lot about their interests and so on and so forth. It's not, we have to take into account their social experiences as well. So, you know, it's a perfectly plausible hypothesis that there might be reasons that they might be more comfortable playing with boys' toys than girls who don't have this condition, have these experiences. So I think the conclusion that this condition shows that fetal testosterone hardwires the brain to be drawn to toys that correspond to this idea that the male brain is more interested in objects. I mean, I just don't think that's that hasn't been demonstrated yet.
We're quickly running out of time, but just to finish off then, let's look at, I suppose, conclusions and what we can do. How can we sort of change society, educate people, educate out inequality?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I'm not really sure, but I think a critical part of it will be for these kind of this misinformation about what science tells us about hardwired sex differences to not continue to have the sort of reinforcing effects that they currently do. I mean, what I came to discover from researching the book is that as long as there's been brain science, there have been what are in retrospect misguided explanations and justifications of sex inequality. So brain scientists have suggested that, you know, women's skulls are the wrong shape, their brains are too small, their hemispheres are too unspecialized, and so on and so forth. And again, these hypotheses eventually find themselves hurled on the scientific scrap heap. But before they do, they become part of cultural lore. I mean, these ideas that I talk about in the book are, you know, there's no popular appreciation of just how much under scientific dispute they are. And they reinforce social attitudes and beliefs about men and women in ways that hinder progress towards greater sex equality. So I think in terms of trying to improve the situation, I think it's really long overdue for us to raise the bar when it comes to the topic of sex differences in the brain. And by that, I don't mean that we need to be more politically correct about the topic, but we actually just need to be more scientifically correct. And I think both neuroscientists and the popular media really need to step up here. There are certainly practices that neuroscientists could put in place to reduce the littering of the literature with spurious findings of sex differences, which often then find themselves in popular books being suggested as reasons why boys and girls should be educated differently, for example. And I think, you know, there are certainly a few neuroscientists who could be more aware of how their implicit assumptions about gender influence the way they interpret results. And I think that journalists and editors who work in the popular media need to be alert to the need to fact-check claims about sex differences in the brain, so both their existence and what they might mean, which is actually a very complicated thing to answer. We're very early on in our journey of understanding how the brain creates the mind, and we're just not really in a position now to be able to say with any confidence what it means for, you know, the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex to activate a little bit more in this experiment, or for the left amygdala to be slightly larger. That's too big a leap for us to make at this moment, but popular writers do so very willingly. And I think the journalists and editors really need to understand this, and I think that the scientific community is probably under some kind of obligation to help them out in this as much as they can, because these kinds of ideas about hardwired differences do affect important social attitudes, and I think we probably need to start being less casual about it.
Cordelia, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.